everyone. Welcome and thanks for coming today. And thanks for the Nobel Peace Center for hosting us today. My name is Asta Gabriel. I'm from Denmark and I'm a second year student at UWC-RCN. And the reason we are here today is because we're going to have this panel, but also during the day we have had workshops in this room with students from high schools here in Oslo coming and talking about youth activism and what are you willing to sacrifice for a cause you believe in was our overall theme. So that's what we have been doing today. And we're going to continue the conversation about activism and youth activism now. And to do this, I want to introduce Marianne Dahl, who is a senior researcher at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo, Penelope Lea, which is a Norwegian climate activist and UNICEF ambassador since the age of 15, and Shahad Sahaka, who is a current student at UWC-RCN from Palestine. So, and we're going to do it like this. You will all get some time to tell about yourself and explain what you're interested in and what you know a lot about. So I think we'll start with you, Marianne.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me here. This is such an exciting panel to be part of. And I'm here to talk a little bit about my research and what we know. And what we know about nonviolent mobilization, mass mobilization, and democratic change, and more specifically, the role of student activism. So I thought that since this is a panel on youth activism and something we actually have a lot of or some knowledge about is the role of students. Not all students are young, and not all young are students, but it's generally it's a good fit for this panel, I was thinking. Okay, so let's take a step back and ask, is nonviolence effective? So for a pretty long time, it was a common assumption that nonviolence was a less efficient strategy than violence. That people who choose nonviolence, either because they lacked the weapons to wage an efficient armed conflict, or because they were morally convicted to a nonviolent principle. But this had not been tested empirically. So when Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffen set out to collect a global data set spanning from 1900 to 2006 and mapping all nonviolent and violent large-scale maximalist campaigns, that's campaigns that apply nonviolent or violent strategies, mobilize more than 1,000 people and have a maximalist goal of either removing the regime or ousting a foreign occupant or seceding from the state. What they found when analyzing these data was that nonviolent campaigns are almost twice as likely to succeed as violent campaigns. Or that Gandhi was right. So that's good news. And the key reason to this is that nonviolent campaigns are just much better at mobilizing people. Most of us would be willing and able to join a nonviolent movement, but most of us would shy away from joining a violent one. And as more people join the movement, the pressure on the regime increases, and it becomes harder to maintain status quo, and sometimes the regime just crumbles, or the incentives to introduce some democratic reforms becomes so great that they do so, and it's game over. Okay, so, but there have been many campaigns where the movement has been successful in removing the autocrat, but where we haven't seen any democratic change afterwards. Take Iran in 1979 or Egypt in 2011. So the fact that nonviolent campaigns tend to be more successful in obtaining their goal, specifically of removing the regime, doesn't necessarily mean that they are also likely to instigate democratic change. So following the research, the seminal book of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffen, many researchers, myself included, have been focusing on whether nonviolent campaigns increase the likelihood that we see democratic change. And what the research field spanning political science, sociology, and economics finds is that nonviolent campaigns increase the likelihood that we see democratic change. So the way to interpret this graph is just to focus on the dark line here, up here, for nonviolent campaigns. And it being above the zero line means that the effect is positive. And the gray area shows you how certain we are. And when it intersects with the zero line, it means that we're quite uncertain, as we are when it comes to the effect of violent campaigns. But when it is above the zero line the whole way, or like up to 10 years after the movement, it means that we're quite certain that there is a systematic effect on nonviolent campaigns on democratic change. And this holds also when we try to account for the possibility that nonviolent campaigns might happen more often in regimes that could be more ripe for democratic change already. How am I doing time-wise? Okay, good. Okay, so that's good. But let's move on to the students. So do students matter in this? There have been a number of campaigns where students have been the dominating group or initiating the campaign, including the anti-Milosevic campaign in Serbia. And one reason why we think that students might play a very significant role is that education is assumed to promote democratic norms and liberal values, making students more invested in democratic change. Also, the skills you get from being a student, the analytical skills, could make you better suited to have the capacity to organize a nonviolent movement, because it requires analytical skills and creativity, and all of this is something we might get a lot of from education. Also, university campuses might serve as a good place. It can offer an infrastructure with formal and informal networks that might make it easier to overcome collective action problems. So if we look at students, But if you see the purple line here, this shows the cumulative graph of the number of campaigns where different social groups have dominated. So this is something we have mapped from 1789 to 2020. So quite a long time span. And what we see, so students are here in purple, and we see that up until 1940, there weren't many movements dominated by students. But then we started to see a number of movements dominated by students, and it accelerated after the 1960s. And amongst the groups that we study, the students is the group most likely to be advocating for democratic change. And from 1789 to 2020, only the military and workers have been taken part in more nonviolent and violent campaigns than students. So it's an extremely significant group. And what we find when we study students, so in Sirianne Dahlen's research, she finds that nonviolent movements, which include students, are more likely to succeed. And we don't find that effect for violent movements. So it means one indication of this is that the skills we get from our education makes us better suited to be part of a nonviolent movement, but not a violent movement. And that resonates with my own experience from the university. Also, student participation. We also find that student participation increases the likelihood that we do see democratic change following a nonviolent campaign. So this is really good. Students have played an extremely important role in nonviolent movements in instigating democratic change. But more important than one group is the research that shows us that we need many groups. So students are extremely important, but for a movement to be successful, we need many groups across different from different social groups to be able to foster democratic change. So I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And now, Penelope?
Yes. I have always said that I'm willing to use every peaceful and nonviolent measure I can think of to work for climate justice. I still am. Nevertheless, more and more often, I find myself worrying about what that means and debating what that actually means today and worrying about what that means might mean for me in the future and how far away that future might be. And what the climate youth movement managed to do in 2019 was, in my opinion, outstanding. And still we see almost none of the changes needed. Where does that leave activists? Where does that leave us? And what kind of methods can we use to protect us and work for actual impact? In my work, I see every day how this situation intensifies for so many people, how the frustration and the anger and the exhaustion increases. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so happy to spend this hour with you today, to talk and listen to your thoughts on activism and experiences. It feels like a long time ago I started my activism. I was about 8 or 9. It's been almost 11 years now. I started because I was, and I still am, sick and tired of violence and inequalities. And the fight for climate justice, the fight for climate action, is the fight against these very forces. For as long as I can remember, I've had a huge amount of impatience in the fight for a peaceful and safe future and present. And this impatience of mine has only grown. And sometimes I find it almost impossible to channel. Being an activist have given me some of the strongest feelings of cohesion in my life. But it has also sometimes made me feel alone and alienated. Maybe that's partly why I quickly realized that as I started out, I wanted to work with people and organizations and systems from different places, nations and cultures. I wanted to hear as many perspectives as I possibly could, as many stories as I possibly could, and I wanted to convey these stories whenever I could. So that is what I've done and got to do through, for instance, work with the UNICEF. Now I have friends and colleagues from all over the world. The climate crisis is an interconnected crisis. It's inevitably linked to the world security situation, to economics and poverty. It's tightly linked to how we understand ourselves and our own history, and of course to every single one of the children and human rights. I believe all freedom fights and fights for justice are linked together, and that the fight for a livable future is linked to every one of them. Therefore, I found myself working with several of these issues over the past 11 years. Before I continue, it's important to me to express my deep respect for activists who work under different circumstances and difficulties and dangers than I do in Norway. According to Global Witness, an average of 4 climate activists are killed every week because of their work. And often, as I work with activists living in authoritarian regimes, I ask them what I can do to help. And almost all of them, unrelated, answer the same thing. Take care of your peace. Take care of your democracy. And sometimes this feels like a too small of a contribution. But they emphasize how they also need our democracy as an example of a liberal democracy. It's about holding the line and not letting undemocratic tendencies stand unchallenged in yet another country. Therefore, I've learned that even though our difficulties cannot in any way be compared to theirs, one of the things that I can contribute with is to take the difficulties and the cracks and the challenges that we do face in the Norwegian democracy and that activists do face with a great amount of seriousness. It's disturbing to see how both peace activists and climate activists are facing increased restrictions in countries like Germany and France and England. And at the same time that people in power let just yet another year pass by without conveying the situation we're in clearly enough, without implementing real solutions, and now without taking a clear stand against genocide. We have a responsibility as one of the few liberal democracies left in the world, to prove that democracy as a form of government works, also under crisis, especially during the climate crisis and war. As to being a climate activist from Norway, it requires, in my opinion, a deep awareness about Norway's historic and present responsibility for the climate and nature crisis. And this responsibility, alongside the privilege that has emerged from the wealth earned through this industry, is, in my experience, something we need to be utterly outspoken about in every room where we talk about climate action. And this might sound strange, but I feel like a very different activist when I work at home than when I work internationally. It's quite two quite different roles to me. Regarding how this conversation folds out in Norway, I think I can safely say that the debate around climate change is one of the most heated and polarized debates that there is in Norway. And in my opinion, it also lacks perspectives. And it scares me. And it scares me that even though we know what our history with oil and gas exploration have contributed to of suffering and loss, we have the economic and the technological responsibility and opportunity to change, and still we don't. To me, that is extremely hard to wrap my mind around. And still, it's something I try to keep in mind always when I work as an activist at home. I have worked with international negotiations and conferences since I was 13. And I've seen how the trust in Norway has weakened and the anger increased. And I believe that that has other political and diplomatic consequences as well, and has the possibility to weaken global negotiations. One in four people in Norway are climate deniers. That is a horrifying statistic. But I realized that I would have found that statistic to be more bearable if only I could also say that 3/4 of Norwegians are outspoken on the need to change and tackle the climate crisis. And I realized I'm more scared of the silence and inaction of the remaining 3/4 of us than I am of the 1/4 of us that are climate deniers. We might never know which of our actions lead to change or may make more people follow in our footsteps. Therefore, everything we do may turn out to be the changing act. I believe that activism in its greatest form is and always will be peace work, peace in progress. There are many realizations that I've learned to hold on to throughout my work to remain resilient. And one of them is that I refuse to believe that we as humans do not understand that what affects others, what affects the society, what affects the future, also always affects us all in one way or another. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Led. And Shahad?
Yeah. So I have my notes on the phone, so excuse me, it's a bit unprofessional, but anyways. So my name is Shahad Zahaika, and I'm a second-year student at the United World College Red Cross Nordic, and I'm an 18-year-old Palestinian woman living in Jerusalem, which, if you know, on paper is considered Israel, which has made me a part of the 0.1% of the world's stateless population. And when I say stateless, I don't mean metaphorically. I mean, like, literally, on paper, I am registered as stateless. I don't have anywhere where I belong or I can call home on paper. So as Palestinians living in Israel, or like as we are referred to, the Arab Israelis, we face a lot of legal restrictions just for being us, being Palestinians. And I think one of the most outrageous to me personally is the fact that it's literally illegal for me to identify out loud as a Palestinian. I am not allowed to call myself a Palestinian in my own land, or else it's literally in the law, like I would face jail or relocation to either Gaza, West Bank, neighboring Arab countries, or other places. Yeah, I think my journey only took a transformative way when I arrived to UWC RCN in Norway. It's where I found a community that encouraged me to speak up, that made me feel heard and seen. And that's when I gathered my courage and decided to speak up and to stop being afraid of the consequences of speaking up against injustices. So I think I've been only active since I arrived to Norway. I wasn't before because I couldn't. But since I arrived to Norway, I've been really embracing it and appreciating my freedom of expression and speech and the fact that I have my rights here. So I've been really active in on campus with like different humanitarian services and activism. For example, I'm part of the Amnesty Fialer group on our campus. I do a lot of like campaigns about Palestine. I helped in organizing a lot and fundraise and a lot of stuff. I also took some activism trainings just because I was never open to activism again. I have never experienced it before. So I think it really helped me being in Norway to take trainings, how to be active in a, and to take the best approach in activism and to, of course, keep myself safe because I'm also putting myself in danger, even speaking out, even here and like anywhere else. And I'm also involved in many other stuff like activities, for example, the Red Cross youth group. And in this group, I helped in organizing a collaboration between the Palestinian Red Crescent back home and the Norwegian Red Cross, where we like had an event in school where we like discussed the Palestinian issue and raised awareness. And we helped in, we did some fundraising for the children's section of the Palestinian Red Crescent. And other a lot of stuff of other events and like many fundraising events for other sections of the Red Cross as well. I'm also like part of many other NGOs. The one that is the closest to my heart is called Do Not Forget NGO, and it's initiated by my second year at the school. It's meant to help Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, and we worked on many projects. One of them that really is close to my heart as well is that we collected 70 kilograms of winter clothing as donations from students on campus and sent them to Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and distributed to them to the people who were in need because it was December at the time and they didn't really, yeah. So we that was one of our projects. Other one was to do like online workshops to us. We were trying to target mostly girls there about education and like help assist them with finding opportunities and scholarship to study abroad and like to continue their higher education because it's common there for students to, because of financial issues, because after the age of 18, the UNRWA schools that they have for free stop. So they have to continue higher education and usually they have to pay for it. So many girls end up choosing early marriages because of this problem. So we really try to target this a particular group, like girls, into helping them to find other opportunities and like to go out of their way to and thrive as they should and what they deserve. And we now are working on a project to collect menstrual hygiene products for women in camps in Lebanon. We were initially targeting women in Gaza, but because of the blockage, we can't really get anything in, so we changed it to Palestinian women in Lebanon. And I think the most recent event I'm very excited about when it comes to activism is in 2 days, I'm delivering a TEDx talk in my school, so... Yeah, that is coming. I think my journey from coming, being suppressed or like not having my freedom of expression to coming here really showed me the strength of community and how a community or an environment can really change a person. Because before I really just lived in the shadows and was hiding my identity because, as I said, it's illegal to identify even as a Palestinian. So I was trying to be as invisible as I could. But here I really found my people. I found the people that will appreciate me for my difference, not to bring me down for it. And I think About going through the war while being here, because I've lived in Jerusalem my whole life, so I was there witnessing everything. But then I think it's especially hard for me because, the highest escalated war happened while I'm here away. And I think the thing that make it even most affecting me is that I didn't even learn about it from the news. I was on my way from, on the bus going from campus to my host family, because I have a host family near campus, Norwegian host family. And on that weekend, I got a call on that bus, and it was from my brother. But then when I picked up the phone, it was his teacher, and she was screaming, shouting for me to come pick him up from school. I was like, hello, I'm in Norway, can't really, sorry. This call was on October 7th, and it was because there was a settler attack on my brother's school after the attack from the other side. So settlers really attacked everything, all kids' schools, not all, but like most kids' schools in Jerusalem and houses and everything. So this was how I learned about the start or the beginning of this very recent war. And I think it's even tougher that I get to live this privileged life in Norway, having my little bubble in Flekke in my campus with my friends, living the perfect life, while my people, my family and friends are being attacked, kidnapped, bombed, and facing just horrific stuff. Especially that my family in particular live in an ethnically cleansed neighborhood. That means that all surrounding my house are illegal chain of settlements, Israeli settlements, and it's very close. Like, my house is very close to the settlements. We are literally neighbors, even closer than neighbors. Those settlements are built on my neighbors' houses. Like, year by year, we would lose Palestinian houses on this illegal settlements that get built on my friends' houses, basically, yeah. And then, I think it just hurts that I'm so far away and I'm so powerless and helpless, while my family can't even leave the house during the day, because if those settlers, by the way, are armed and they have their weapons, and they are even encouraged to use them against us, especially now that it's declared war by Israel. And they don't really face consequences if they use them because it's official war. So they really embrace it, I'm telling you. And they like to use their weapons against us for the alibi of defending themselves. And I just feel, as I said, guilty for being able to live this peaceful life. And I wish that my family and friends get the same experience of living peace. And when I say peace, I mean actual peace. I mean not the performative peace we had before October 7th. Because whoever claims that we had peace before October 7th, I'm sorry, but you're living in denial. It was a performative peace. It was when I want to have my rights. I want to be able to act upon them. I want to be able to embrace them. I don't just want to have them on paper. I want to be able to legally and out loud identify as a Palestinian with no consequences. And it just breaks my heart that we need to fight to convince people that Palestinians are humans. We deserve to live. We deserve to be able to be sitting in our homes without being bombed randomly. We deserve to be humans, and we do not deserve to be dehumanized. No person on this earth should be dehumanized in the way the world dehumanized Palestinians. And some try to claim that, but the situation is really complex. I'm sorry, but in my opinion, human rights are not complex. You either believe in them or you don't. Thank you.
Thank you, Shahad, and thanks to all of you. I want to ask a general question to all of you, and it's about how activism is a unique type of power in order to influence change compared to other means of influencing change. Why do you think activism is unique? in that sense?
I believe activism is believing in single actions. It's believing in community actions, but it's not underestimating anything. And it's taking injustice that others experience or yourself personally. And if you manage to make an inclusive movement and rooted in community and organizations and with an act that is accessible for many, I think activism is on its greatest because it can show how many people work for issues that are important to the society as a whole. And I think what I believe is one of the most beautiful things about activism is that you can be an activist on so many, in so many different ways, on so many different levels, and we need all of them. So there is a role for you. There is always a role for you, and that makes a very inclusive movement.
Now you say inclusive, and I thought about like climate change and the activism that has been around that, and like now we talk about youth activism. So why do you feel especially youth activism is important, and is there sometimes some generation gaps or like when we talk about youth activism, why is especially youth activism important?
Personally, I believe young people might see the world in a different way than adults do, and that is a way we desperately needs to see the world as well at some points, and that it might be a very healthy way to look at it, and it might, yeah. So perspectives.
I think also the impatience you talked about that you had when you, as you grew up, maybe we'll, I'm still impatient, but maybe we'll lose some of that with time. So it's an extremely powerful part of society when it mobilizes.
You all talked about like living in Norway and as a peaceful and democratic country, and like what relationship, not relationship, what responsibility do you mean we have in Norway concerning activism, also about not Norwegian problems, but what responsibility with the privilege of living in Norway that is safe and where freedom of expression is protected? And I'm again asking all of you.
So I think human rights are universal, and we're in an extremely privileged position here. So, but that doesn't mean that we don't have any responsibility beyond our own borders, as you both pointed to. So I definitely think we have a responsibility in that.
Of course we do. And everyone who has the responsibility and the opportunity, not only the responsibility, but the opportunity to, should speak about the issues that concerns other parts of the world as well, because we're all connected. We live in the same world in very different circumstances, but we do live in the same world. And it's what I said, that what affects others in one way or another will affect us all. Even though I wish I didn't have to say that. I wish it would be other things that drove us to act and fight for issues that are important for the majority of the world. But yes, it's true nonetheless. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm very grateful to be able to have my freedom of expression and speech and to be privileged in Norway. But at the same time, I think it's sad that we call it a privilege that someone has their right to speech. Isn't it universal right? To speech or to express yourself. So it's like sad that now if you have that right, you're privileged. But I'm a bit confused, but I thought that was universal. So yeah, it's a bit sad. But I'm also happy, and I would like to encourage all the people that have this privilege to use it, because others don't. And people really need someone to speak up for them. And these injustices just shouldn't be normalized in the way they are. And I think we should all speak up and be the voice of the voiceless.
And you also talked before about this, that it's first when you came to Norway, you could use your freedom of expression and do activism. What are you most proud of the things you have organized within the school community?
Yeah, I think I organized and I participated in a lot, but one thing I'm really proud of, and I feel like it's a success to me. It's very recent, like a few weeks ago, we organized a strike in our school, which was we in our school there's 200 students, and then we had a misfortunate experience when we went to one of the demonstrations in the town next to us, near us, and then we felt that we felt a bit of lack of action from our school as a institution, and we wanted to urge them to take action. So we organized a strike where we did not go to school for a full academic day. We skipped classes to protest or to demonstrate in front of the admin's building as a way to show them that, like to ask them or to urge them to reconsider, to reevaluate their actions or lack of action. And because I think also, because we are a Red Cross school, I think for our school it wasn't very clear where the lines are or where how to act as a Red Cross school, because there are, of course, heavy lines you can't cross as a representative of the Red Cross. But I think in our school, it wasn't very clear, and even the administration wasn't very clear where to stand in it. So I think after that strike, it really helped, because more than half of the campus was there just sitting, and it was very cold. We were just sitting there for a whole day in front of the admin school, the admin's building. And we had like letters of demands where we asked the school to post on their social media to not necessarily make statements, but at least to post about our personal experience. It's the school's students' personal experiences, because we have 7 Palestinians in the school, and each of us have different personal experience, and some of them are from Gaza. And we thought it was very important for the school to participate and support us and to be able to like share those people's stories and GoFundMes and whatsoever. And I think it really worked well, and it gained a lot of support from the students, which I was very happy about. And even the staff and admin, they took it well. And it really changed a lot after the strike. The school has published a post on Instagram with the GoFundMes and everything. And we have been working better on like some projects, or like how to change it to the better. So I think that's something I'm really proud of, because especially that like it's like a very it's an international school where like on that sitting in front of admin buildings there was like 50 nationalities. So I was like, yeah.
Yeah. Now you're talking about being a young activist, and you also started very early. Now that we're talking about youth activism, I wanted to ask you, Penelope, if you have experienced any like specific challenges or felt like you had to prove more as being a young woman, like fighting for a case and doing activism, and have you been perceived in discussions and talks about this? Have you met any specific challenges being young?
Definitely. you know, I've experienced being taken seriously, and I've experienced being hated at, pitied, shoved away or ghosted or mansplained. But I've also experienced being asked about the advice from politicians, consulted, been listened to, been cheered on. I think I've experienced the whole scale, or I might not, maybe there's more to come, but I at least experienced a lot of things. We talked about the age part at the beginning, and I just need to add something, because when we talk about age in the face of the climate crisis and the climate movement and working for climate justice and action, I think it's often something different from when we talk about age in other movements, for instance, and other cases and issues, because the climate crisis is also an intergenerational failure or betrayal, and that the people in power now, or the people who have been in power the last years, have known for so long how their actions affects the younger generations or people living other places in the world, how much suffering they would need to go through. And still they continue. And they've even had the possibility and the time to change and known and seen how many young people who wanted to change and still they've done not. And that is a big generational betrayal. Having said that, I also need to add that even though a lot of politicians and decision makers and people in general have known about the causes and the impacts of climate change for a long time, not all parents have. And that is also proven that a lot of the oil and gas companies, and when they started out, actually knew the consequences of their actions. They knew how much harm it could cause for generations to come and people living other places, and they still went on. They were even warned by their own scientists, and they deliberately tried to suppress them. It's proven in their documents. And even build up environments of climate denial that didn't exist beforehand. So, yes, it's a generational betrayal, but it's also about companies and a few people wanting to earn a lot of money and living the consequences of the majority of us. It's also the fight against between capitalism and the working class and the majority of us. Yeah. So.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to you talked about nonviolent activism, and you also talked about how you wanted to use all peaceful methods to obtain the goal, but that you also were really frustrated and like fighting for a case and feel like continue and nothing happens. Like, I want to ask you, Marianne, because we talked about this earlier, I mean, Shahad, about to what extent does protesting and activism need to be nonviolent, and is violent activism sometimes needed in order to change something?
Okay, so that's a very good question. And of course, there are different circumstances where I'm not going to say that I think Ukraine should have had a nonviolent response to Russia, Russia's invasion, for example. There are situations where it's really, really hard to make the mechanisms of nonviolence work. In general, what you need is to mobilize many people who can actually affect the people in power. And for that to happen, it's better to be within the country than outside of the country. And these are aspects of nonviolence that we have to take seriously. But within a country, nonviolence tends to work much better than violence. And it also tends to hurt the movement when there are aspects of violence being used, when you have a violent flank or when you have some individuals that do apply violence. And one thing that we see is that when minority groups within a country mobilize, they are more often portrayed as being violent compared to when it's the dominant group that is mobilizing. So how we are portrayed is not only a result of the actions that we make, but it's also partly a result of the position we have in a society. And when you look at the big leaders, civil society leaders, Gandhi would always believe in nonviolence. Martin Luther King almost always believed in nonviolence, but also thought that there were situations and people who were just so horrible that maybe it wouldn't work. So yeah, more of an opening to that than Gandhi. Mandela, on his side, he would say that there is no... he has this quote. It's something... there is no good morality in using an inefficient weapon. He would use nonviolence because it wasn't strategically, it was a better weapon. So there are many ways to come to this, but I think in general we should definitely the way to mobilize people and get people to sympathize with our cause is through nonviolence. And as soon as something becomes violent, it becomes much harder to create sympathy for the cause.
Thank you. And I also wanted to ask you about the graph you showed with youth activism or student activism increasing. Why do you think that activism is like increasing in like significance, or like that student activism is increasing?
Okay, so two things are happening. We're both seeing more activism today than we did before. 2019 was named the year of mobilization. It's there's a lot of mobilization going around. Some people argued in 2019 that we had never seen as many people taking to the streets. And there could be several reasons to this. One reason could be that social media is making it easier to mobilize many people within short time. Mm. It could also be that there are just so much tension. But there has been tension before also, but there's a lot going on at the moment, or at least it feels that way. There's a lot to mobilize around, so that's probably part of the reason also. When it comes to students becoming such a major force in this, partly it's because that education is spreading. So there are simply many more students today than there was in the 1940s, for example. There is a bigger pool to draw from.
Thank you. And here, going towards the end, I just wanted to ask you how we can use activism and what, like, youth activism's importance in, like, right now, today's world, in order to change conflicts and crises around the world. How can we use activism today, and how does it lead to specific change? Yeah, I'm looking at all of you, if you have any.
Yeah. So I'm just going to start.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So, mobilization from below, so people taking to the streets and strikes and sit-ins, it has changed so many extremely difficult situations. Look to the civil rights movements in the US or to the end of the apartheid system. These things would never have happened if it hadn't been for activism. And these are all these maximalist claims. But there are also all these instances where claims have been non-maximalist, but substantial for the individuals living in these situations, where things have gotten much better because of mass mobilization. So I think it's still an extremely powerful force, which we need to continue to use, because there are definitely enough issues to tackle.
Yeah, we know that activism works. We have experienced it over so many years, and some of the most well-needed and awaited changes in society and through history has come from people movements, from mobilization and from youth movements. The women's rights movement in so many different forms in so many different countries, or the fight against apartheid, and so many fights have been born by people movements. And it has great power. We need to continue working to not lose faith in the ability we have as individuals working together. Because if we do, we weaken a very important democratic principle. When it comes to the climate crisis, because I've realized that over the past years, people have thought about and talked about how young people in Norway seem to be less engaged about the climate movement now than they were 5 years ago. That is not, in my experience, true. But they henvise til, refer to a research that was done earlier this spring, or earlier this summer last year, that said that young people have a lot more apathy now than before. And I think it's, just on an ending note, it's important to remember that when young people that do not have access to all the tools in a democracy that adults do, use so much time and power and energy on creating such an extraordinary mass mobilization as they did in 2019, for instance, the climate strikes, and still see so little change, it might make young people lose faith in their own ability to influence in society. And yes, then we weaken a very important democratic principle. And I think believing in ourselves and believing in that power from individuals is extremely important now in the years to come to spark the movement.
Yeah, I agree. And I definitely think that mobilization and, like, posting about issues and, like, you don't have to actively, I mean, of course, I encourage you, but then the least you can do is, like, talk about stuff and, like, post. And I think something that really demonstrated to me that activism work, and especially mobilization, is that, like, for example, we are very censored on social media, especially about the Palestine issue. Like the whole Meta, Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp, everything is very censored about Palestine. And also Israel does not allow, especially Palestinians or people, its citizens to post. And this shows the power of activism or of mobilization and activism, because even a whole state is like going this far to prohibit its citizens or prohibit people from posting because they know that now people can be educated very easily. And if people are educated and know the truth, it might be a problem for them. So I think it really shows how mobilization works, and it really does affect activism. And yeah, I think that we should all be active. And we are, of course, on a spectrum, can be different levels, but I think every one of us that believe in human rights should take action in a cause they believe in, no matter what. Yeah.
And I think talking about youth activism and mobilization and getting young people to participate in this, we had the workshops today, we had three workshops, and something I noticed was in many of the classes we came, the first question we asked them, there was this like exercise where you could like yes or no, and we asked if they had ever participated in a demonstration or done activism, and in many of the classes there was like one or two students that had participated. And then before, we also talked about how we, as living in Norway, have a responsibility because we have the right to freedom of expression. And as Shahad mentioned, like we can post things on social media. How is your experience with Norwegian youth activism? Is it well established? How can we encourage more youth to be involved?
You know, my experience is that if you sign up for an organization, we have a lot of organizations in Norway working with young people and climate issues or human rights issues. And if you sign up, they are well organized and there is a role for you. So I think it's spreading the awareness that there is many organizations for young people to participate in, and so the people will know about them and know that they can do activism on so many different levels and in so many different ways.
Do you have anything to?
No, but I've gotten a complaint from my 5-year-old daughter that we are going to too many demonstrations. So hopefully that creates something good into the future.
Yeah.
And I read a Harvard study like a couple of weeks ago that shown that activism, there's more small demonstrations now than it was before, but they are less victorious. Mm. That activism is less victorious now than in all times of history. And I think there are many reasons for that, of course, but I believe in a movement that is organized by like strong organizations and organizational work, community work. I think that is one of the most efficient ways of working. And when it comes to, for instance, the Fridays for Future movement, in a lot of countries, the Fridays for Future organization in itself became the organization for young people to participate in democratically in their countries. And in Norway, we haven't seen that, and that's partly why, because we have so many other organizations that work for these issues. And I think it's to make a movement work and to make activism work and be inclusive, we need to find one simple action that is accessible for a lot of people to use, like school striking, as you did, or as the Fridays for Future movement have done, that can include a lot of people from different backgrounds and in different places of the world. Yeah.
Thank you. I think the last thing I want to ask you about is to end on a good note, like good experiences with activism and successful in achieving peace, if you have any examples or anything you've studied or personal experiences.
Yeah, so there's just a host of examples of activists being successful. Take Bolivia in 2019, Romania in 1999, and all of these cases have been difficult. But I just want to say one last thing, because you brought this up about declining success rate of nonviolent campaigns, because it's hard to get to deny the fact that nonviolent campaigns have been less successful over the last years. And this could just be a dip in what's happening, but one of the reasons we think it might be is still far too premature to conclude is just what you're saying about organizations. We really, really need organizations. And I think we had this overly optimistic view when it came to social media, that we could organize things on social media, it would bring people together. But it turns out that autocrats are probably even better to use social media in their favor. But what we need is just to go back. It seems to be the case that we need to go back to the traditional organizations, which are a better way to mobilize and to sustain mobilization over time. So yeah, just want to back that up.
Yeah. And when it comes to like social media, I think it's a great way to mobilize and reach people with knowledge, and especially in the Palestine cause, for instance, we've seen how much it has meant to so many people and for awareness. But when it comes to the climate crisis as well, but I also it's been a long day. I often feel alone on social media, and that community work and being together when you fail or being together when you have successes, it can be really important to sustain yourself when you need to work as an activist for a long time, because what we know is that these issues won't go away overnight. We need to be active members of society for a long time, our whole lives, preferably, and to do that in a sustainable way, you need the comfort, I believe, of the people around you. When it comes to like successes of activism, yeah, it's so many examples to take from, but a recent example I want to bring up is I've worked with climate activists from Poland, and that's worked up against election for democracy in Poland, and they managed these big and huge campaigns to get young women to vote that previously it was said in research that they were less likely to vote before the election, like half a year before the election, these research came out, and they did something about that with making campaigns for women to vote, and then they traveled around the whole country to activate young women to vote. And they are climate activists, so they see the connection between democracy and climate and women's rights as a whole, and they succeeded. So that's a really powerful example just in new times.
I think social media, especially in the Palestine issue, really made a change. Especially that, for example, in the Western perspective, it was really not very clear to them what was actually happening, or like any of like the history or like anything. But then I think social media really helped, because like even the news, the Western news, BBC, like all these channels, they would only project the Israeli perspective. And in the Western education system, if it's included in it, it will be from the Israeli perspective as well. So I think social media really brought the light, like shed the light on the Palestinian perspective and the Palestinian personal stories, because there's not just one stereotype of a Palestinian story. There's many, there's hundreds, and they are all so different because of the different parts you live at, different circumstances. So I think it really brought attention to the cause and raised awareness about what's actually happening. And I would say many people were brainwashed before, especially before this recent war, because of course we would mention it on media a bit, but this recent war really brought like big attention to it and made a lot of change, and brought activism and like organized protests. And it's also like helpful to like, to post about a protest happening in your local area to gain support, and people would know about it from social media and come. So it was a really good tool to use. And I think it also like put pressure on governments, because at some point it just became embarrassing to some governments to be like, you know, seen like that in social media, and that activists from those countries changed their perspective and became against their actions and called them out. And like with Amnesty, for example, lobbying and like all these tools being shared on social media and seeing people speaking up really encourages others. It's also, I would like to talk about the emotional aspect for it for Palestinians, because living in Palestine, we can't really post or we can't really know anything, and we can't do any demonstrations or protests. So it really feels that we are seen and heard and people do care for us, and we are not dehumanized. I think we are, but we are not as dehumanized as we think to others. And just seeing that, like, a post that hundreds of people were demonstrating in Oslo, or like thousands, is just really touching to us, and it shows us that people are in solidarity with us, and we're not just a trend, and we will not be forgotten, hopefully. So I think, yeah, it really was positive on both sides, personal for me, for example, and global, to bring activism. So, yeah.
Thank you for that. Do you have anything else you want to add on the topic of the power of youth activism before I...
Oh, we could talk about this for hours, for days.
Yeah.
But it's been really nice to hear your research and hear your stories and your activism. It's been really, really nice this evening.
Yeah. And I just want to say thank you to all the three of you, and it has been very, very interesting. And thanks for coming, and thanks for all of you for coming and listening. And yeah, you will be around afterwards, so people can also ask you more questions if you sit with them. But I just want to say thank you to the three of you, and thanks to all of you.
And join organizations.